For What's Universal Time, stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Lori London reporting. The United States added 8 countries Thursday to its blacklist of nations it said are doing the least to end the $150 billion worldwide human trafficking industry. Secretary of State John Kerry said the State Department put the former Soviet states of Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan on the list of its 27 worst offenders.
We're talking about slavery, modern day slavery, that still today claims more than 20 million victims on any given time.
The report showed Kuwait and Thailand making efforts to combat the trade in humans, but still under scrutiny. The detention of 10 U.S. sailors by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps earlier this year was wholly preventable. That from Admiral John Richardson, who announced Thursday that a report of the January incident was due to several problems with the sailors, including the fact that they were delayed, unprepared, and poorly supervised.
The goal of this investigation was to conduct a thorough review of what U.S. Navy actions may have contributed to this incident.
The report also said the boats committed an unplanned and unauthorized deviation that caused them to transit unknowingly through Iranian territorial seas. The United Nations Security Council is strongly condemning the triple suicide attack that killed at least 44 people and wounded hundreds more at Turkey's busiest airport. The council expressed its sympathy and its condolences to the families of the victims and to the Turkish government. Authorities say they believe the attacks are the work of the Islamic State group, though no one has yet to claim responsibility. This is VOA. The Pentagon has lifted its ban on transgender men and women serving openly in the military. Defense Secretary Ash Carter made the announcement Thursday.
Our mission is to defend this country. And we don't want barriers unrelated to a person's qualification to serve preventing us from recruiting or retaining the soldier, sailor, airman, or marine who can best accomplish the mission.
He said servicemen and women can serve openly immediately and will no longer be discharged just for being transgender. He said there are currently an estimated 2,500 transgender people serving in active duty. The announcement follows a year-long study by the RAND Corporation that concluded there would be minimal readiness impacts from allowing transgender people to serve openly. The change removes one of the last barriers to the military service by any individual. In what it calls a milestone, the United Nations reports humanitarian aid has now reached all of Syria's 18 besieged areas. The UN said this is the first time the besieged towns of Arbin and Zamalka outside of Damascus have received international assistance since November 2012. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN reports a 37-truck convoy rolled into the towns of Arbin and Zamalka Wednesday evening. They were carrying food, water, sanitation, hygiene, and other emergency supplies for 20,000 needy Syrian men, women, and children. There was, however, a downside. Jan Egelin, senior advisor to the UN Special Envoy for Syria, says one driver was shot in the chest by a sniper. He says the driver is receiving treatment in a hospital in Damascus.
But it was a very close call. And it shows how risky this work is. All odds that we have been able to reach all of the 18 areas at least once and at least with partial assistance.
Egelin says he worries that the tens of thousands of starving people who received the first UN aid deliveries in January might once again be starving. He says another matter of great concern is the UN's inability to provide medical services and supplies to the thousands of people trapped in the besieged area. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Canada has launched a task force to study the regulation of recreational marijuana ahead of a legalization measure the government plans to send to Parliament in the spring of 2017. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau had promised to legalize the drug during his 2015 campaign. Meanwhile, California voters will decide when to legalize marijuana for recreational use in November. I'm Lori London
in
Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington. Today is Friday, July 1st, and here are some of the stories we are covering for you. The U.S. State Department released its annual trafficking in persons report Thursday, and again, Africa continues to be a major source and destination for human trafficking of all kinds. Burundi's Foreign Minister Alain Nyamitwe led a delegation of the Foreign Diplomatic Corps to tour parts of the country as part of the East African Nations Diplomatic Day.
It's an annual event to let the Diplomatic Corps to have the feel of the situation in the country and also to engage with the authorities on different matters.
Alain Nyamitwe is Burundi's foreign minister. More than a year ago, Nigeria's Adamawa State on the border with Cameroon was the scene of fierce fighting between Boko Haram and Nigeria's military. Now that relative peace has been restored, people are trickling back to find out what is left of their livelihoods. And a survey shows that 75% of Kenyans are worried about the recent vote by Britain to leave the European Union.
Asking Kenyans, you know, what they think and their perspective on Brexit. You had a very high response rate and everyone responded on their mobile phones.
Kenfield Griffith is the CEO of MSurvey, a global mobile survey technology. Those stories plus Mark Owuma's sports are coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. The U.S. State Department released its annual trafficking in persons report Thursday, and again, Africa continues to be a major source and destination for human trafficking of all kinds, from forced labor to sexual slavery. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg, South Africa.
Again this year, not one African nation made the report's top tier, which is dominated by developed Western nations like the United Kingdom, the United States, and Australia. The State Department says the ratings are based more on the extent of government action to combat trafficking than on the size of the country's problem. A significant number of African countries remain at the lowest possible ranking. Susan Coppedge, a senior advisor to the U.S. Secretary of State, said the migrant crisis that saw more than a million Africans, Iraqis, and Syrians flee to Europe last year has had a negative effect. She said the U.S. is trying to help the destination countries screen for trafficking victims.
So the migrant crisis creates a whole new pool of individuals who are vulnerable and susceptible to trafficking. If they are stateless or without documents or without jobs or without their families, they become vulnerable to the false promises that traffickers can give them for jobs or safety or shelter.
Jacob Christensen, a program manager for Awareness Against Human Trafficking, an anti-trafficking group in Nairobi, says he's especially worried about the effect of ongoing conflict in East and Central Africa.
I think the main change is the different migration patterns that, you know, we are seeing at the moment from places like Burundi and Somalia and South Sudan.
The report notes that in 2015, six African nations improved or introduced anti-trafficking legislation. It also noted that countries that improved, like Burkina Faso, the lone improver in West Africa, stepped up efforts to prosecute and convict traffickers. 10 African countries slid to the State Department's Tier 2 watch list this year. A Tier 3 ranking, the lowest level, can have financial consequences. Countries with that rating may face restrictions on non-humanitarian, non-trade-related assistance from the U.S. The U.S. may also lobby the International Monetary Fund to deny loans to Tier 3 nations. Half of the 27 nations on the Tier 3 list are in Africa, including two fresh demotions this year, Djibouti and Sudan. The tiny East African nation of Djibouti saw some 90,000 migrants pass through last year, creating opportunities for traffickers preying on vulnerable people. The report criticized Djibouti for not doing more to protect victims. Sudan, which separated from South Sudan in 2011, saw more trafficking because of movement of people between South Sudan and from heavy flows of African and Syrian refugees through the country. The report also expressed concern over child labor in Sudan. The report acknowledges that no nation is without problems, including the U.S., and that ending trafficking is a difficult task and one with many complex roots. But the report says it is too important of a problem to ignore. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Burundi's Foreign Minister Alain Nyamitwe led a delegation of the Foreign Diplomatic Corps to tour parts of the country Thursday as part of the East African Nations Diplomatic Day. It's an annual event where diplomats, residents and non-residents accredited to Burundi are taken to various parts of the country to feel and see the situation as well as engage with senior government officials. Critics say the tour organized by the government in Burundi for the diplomatic corps is a face-saving publicity stunt. They contend the government is trying hard to convince the diplomats that the country is at peace with no tension or escalating violence. In an interview with reporter Peter Clotty, Nyamitwe also denied reports that the country remains tense despite regional efforts to mediate a dialogue between the government, civil society and opposition groups to resolve the political challenges the country faces.
It has allowed, again, the diplomatic community to see for themselves that the country is doing well. You know, you hear a lot in the media. You hear sorts of reports that do not paint in good light, the situation in the country.
Some of the critics are saying that the government only wants to show these diplomats what the government wants to show, and that several of the areas that have witnessed violence, the government decided not to show these diplomats the true picture of what is happening in the country vis-a-vis tension among different groups, especially those who are opposed to the government.
That is not true, Peter. Look, we've said time and again that the situation in the country, in as much we might have challenges, is not desperate as it has been said by some quarters. We have said that we have no other country but Burundi, and we can only show them Burundi. And you cannot say that you know Burundi if you do not go inside the country, if you do not go up country and see the people on the ground and see the people up country in the, on the hills and see them in what they do on a daily basis. You can't say that you know Burundi. So they have seen themselves that Burundi is at peace. I mean, how else would you want to know the country, or how else would you know that the country is at peace if you do not go from 100 kilometers or 300 kilometers inside the country and see for yourself? What else should we show them than what we are able to see ourselves? Sometimes I'm afraid people are talking about another Burundi that we do not know.
I was speaking with a few Burundians, and they were saying that if this is a true picture, then the government should allow these diplomats to see things for themselves rather than trying to point them at point A or point B, or letting them see what the government wants to see.
What is it that they want to see that they have not been able to see? Every time you have received a request by an embassy to go inside the country for projects, because that's what they should be doing. Because their work is to go and visit households inside the country. If there's no project, that's not what embassies should be doing. And I think that's not what embassies should be doing in Washington either. So what is acceptable internationally is what is being done. We are not creating or making up the diplomacy. I mean, we're doing exactly what is acceptable internationally.
Some reports that we hear recently is that the country is still tensed, and that the government has not been able to ease the tension in the country, and that they are worried that there could be ethnic dimensions to it. What is your response to such reports?
Please, we have had those sorts of reports time and again. We have had those reports back in the months that have passed, but everybody now knows that those reports were not real, did not match the reality on the ground. We have had issues, fine, but did we have a genocide, or did we have ethnic tensions at that time or today? I do not think so. We have political problems. Fine. I mean, nobody can deny that there are opposition parties that are not happy for the government, and that's only political, but it is not ethnic. If you look at the political class and look, you know, in its composition, you find out that you have Hutus in the opposition, as you have Hutus in the government, you have Tutsis in the government, as you have Tutsis in the opposition. But I don't think it's a Hutu versus Tutsi kind of conflict or tension that we're having today. I challenge anybody who will be in a position to prove to us that that is the case. That's nonsense kind of analysis.
Alain Nyamitwe is Burundi's foreign minister. He spoke with reporter Peter Cloti from the capital, Bujumbura. Around the world, including the African continent, the reactions to Brexit have been generally negative. This is because of the size of the British economy. Many are worried of its impact on the economies of developing countries. Last month, Kenya's central bank governor, Patrick Njoroge, warned about the risks, saying that Brexit would increase market volatility. A recent survey carried out in Kenya's capital, Nairobi, and other surrounding towns shows that Kenyans are worried of the impact Brexit will have on their economy. The survey was carried out by M-Survey, a global mobile survey technology that enables users to capture real-time feedback directly from target audiences. It shows that 62% of respondents disagree with Great Britain's decision to leave the EU, while 75% of respondents expressed concern about the Brexit decision. Kenfield Griffith is the founder and CEO of M-Survey. I reached him in Kingston, Jamaica.
We send out a survey on M-Survey platform asking Kenyans, you know, what they think and their perspective on Brexit. We had a very high response rate and everyone responded on their mobile phone.
Now, Ken, how much were Kenyans following the news of Brexit?
I mean, obviously, because Kenya is a former colony, they're very, very exposed to it. So I think, you know, even just reading from or looking at the results, they're very aware of it. But some haven't heard, like I think it was 62% of folks did not hear about the term Brexit. But, you know, there was another six, you know, folks that did hear about it. They were very, very concerned about different issues around the UK leaving the EU. So the term was not widely known. But the folks that did know about it, they were very, very concerned about the issue of Brexit.
Okay. And how did you conduct the poll, and what demographics did you base it on?
So we use M-Survey. So M-Survey is a mobile survey platform accessing, you know, the most rural areas in Kenya, right? So anyone from Nairobi to, you know, to north, on the border, we get folks to participate in the survey. So M-Survey is a platform that lets anyone communicate via mobile messaging, specifically via SMS, right? So it ties into the telcos to allow people to give their feedback on simple mobile messaging, back and forth conversations. And what we like to call it is engaging conversations at scale.
Did you target a certain age demographic? Were you sending it out to anybody, to everybody?
It was random. You know, in Kenya alone, we have access to over 21 million people. They just randomly select 200 people, and anyone is, those who respond gets to participate in the survey.
And what kind of information can we get out of their responses or the results of the polls on the news of Brexit?
So from more specifically, you know, from the news of Brexit, you know, I think what was very, very interesting is that 74% of respondents expressed concern about the Brexit decision, right? And I think more so, you know, there was a good percentage of folks who were concerned about the issue of immigration, right, and travel. Right, and then, you know, 79% of the 72 their biggest concern was on the effects on the global economy. As you know, that Kenya has a very interesting relationship with the UK, so it was quite interesting.
Given that over 60% of the respondents say that the decision by Britain to leave the European Union was negative. I guess then we won't be seeing any Kenyans asking for their government to quit the African Union.
Yes, actually, that's a great insight, right? And I think you know, I think they look at the union as positive, right? And I think, you know, looking at cross-border trade and also just access, right? I mean, if you look at what's going on between South Africa and Zim, right, Zimbabwe, I mean, that's an example of that. If you have these, like, cross-border unions where someone, you know, folks can go back and forth, you know, for opportunities. And I think that, I think, you know, from the Kenyan perspective, I think they're looking at also as opportunity, right? Opportunity of trade, opportunity of travel. So, you know, they were very, very concerned. And they spoke positively about how, and I think you summed it up nicely, how the African Union, you know, is a positive thing for them.
Kenfield Griffith is the founder and CEO of MSurvey, a global mobile survey technology. I reached him in Kingston, Jamaica. Uganda has just one doctor for every 25,000 people, and healthcare can be particularly hard to access in rural areas. But a medical hotline is bridging the gap using social media to allow Ugandans to talk directly with certified doctors and pharmacists. Elizabeth Pulat has more from Kampala.
The phones don't actually ring that much at the office of the medical concierge group in Kampala. People primarily contact them via WhatsApp and other messaging platforms. Using social media keeps the overhead down and allows the group to offer the 24-hour hotline service for free. Dr. Yvette Wibibara, who works at the call center, says the questions often reflect local health outreach initiatives.
Certain seasons, they publicize about health topics, menstruation, immunization. So depending on what's going on with the UNICEF publications, that's what we get here most. The other platform, we have incoming and outgoing calls. There we go.
The man on the phone has a question about his wife. He's worried she's suffering from a post-childbirth complication. The hotline gets about 50,000 questions a month. They also bring in specialists. When VOA visited their office, a Ugandan cancer specialist was doing an hour-long tweet-up, taking and answering questions on Twitter. Workers at the center say they spend a lot of time correcting common health myths, such as vaccinations are dangerous or that contraception causes long-term damage to women. The platform also helps people who are too embarrassed to broach traditionally taboo subjects with their local healthcare provider, says Dr. John Mark Buanaka.
The questions are quite varied and spread out, but a lot of the questions, especially from the young people, are on sexual and reproductive health issues. Things like, how do I use a condom? Where do I get testing for HIV? Where do I get post-abortal care? Or if I want to do abortion, what kind of services are available? What kind of services are not available?
The group hopes to expand its service, not just here in Uganda, but throughout the region. Elizabeth Pola for VOA News, Kampala.
More than a decade ago, Nigeria's Adamawa State on the border with Cameroon was the scene of fierce fighting between Boko Haram and Nigeria's military. Now that relative peace has been restored, people are trickling back to find out what is left of their livelihoods. For VOA, Christine traveled to the state and has this report.
Rain soaks what is left of the EYN Church in Michika. The last service here in September 2014 ended in gunfire when Boko Haram insurgents stormed the town. Within days, they reduced the church to rubble. They did the same to many of Michika's shops, homes, and marketplaces. Boko Haram is gone now, and residents are trickling back. EYN now holds services in an open-sided shelter next to the rubble of their old church. Parishioner Hassan Dauda says hundreds of worshippers have yet to return.
There are mixed-up reasons. Some, their houses have been burned down. That's one of the reasons. They don't have shelters. Some are still afraid of coming back.
Boko Haram started in neighboring Borno State as a radical movement aiming to bring strict Islamic law to Nigeria's north. By 2014, it had begun taking over towns and villages, at one point controlling an area the size of Belgium. That included parts of northern Adamawa State. Since early 2015, troops from Nigeria and neighboring countries, aided by local vigilantes, have pushed Boko Haram out of urban areas. What Boko Haram left behind was ruins. A school in Michika has been rebuilt, but teacher Tumba Tumba Kwaha says the damage in the villages is severe.
Outside Michika, they have burned all the necessary places that we used them. Houses, schools, and they have killed many people.
The fighting has done $9 billion in damage to the northeast, according to a recent Nigerian government assessment. The humanitarian toll was worse. More than 20,000 people are thought to have been killed since the insurgency began, and 2.7 million forced to flee their homes. Husseini Bunja is a vigilante who fought to remove Boko Haram from the Adamawa state town of Gombe. In the heat of the fighting, a bullet ripped through his arm. Now he can't work. He says he gets assistance from traders and friends who are aware of his injury. He'll wait outside his house for people to give him money, anywhere from $1 to $2 or less. He also gets help from a charity. Gombe today is peaceful, with traders lining the busy roadway connecting Adamawa to Borno State. But the charred buildings and destroyed churches show the toll Boko Haram took on the town. And danger remains. 2 days after VOA visited Michika, Boko Haram attacked a funeral in a village north of the town, killing 18 people. Chris Stein for VOA News, Michika, Nigeria.
And now it's time for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here's Mark Awoma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, Jackson. In our Daybreak Africa Sports news, we begin with athletics. Ayana Almaz clocked 30 minutes and 7.00 seconds to win the women's 10,000 meters at the Ethiopian Olympic trial for the event in Hengelo, the Netherlands, on Wednesday night. This is the eighth fastest time ever on the all-time list and the world's fastest time for the event in 8 years. Veteran Gelete Burka was second in 30 minutes and 48 seconds, while Olympic champion Tirunish Dibaba was third in 30 minutes and 53 seconds. Netsemesh Gudesh Ayana Aeleu and Sentebere Teferi also completed the race in under 31 minutes. Meanwhile, the 2012 World Junior Champion Yigram Damelash clocked 26 minutes and 51.11 seconds to win the men's race at the same trial. Abadi Mbaye and Tamirat Tola followed him across the finish line. Moving on to Kenya, the world 5,000-meter silver medalist Caleb Ndiku powered his way to victory in a tactical 5,000 meters in 13 minutes and 27.2 seconds at the Kenya on the first day of the Kenya Olympic trial in Eldoret, Western Kenya. Isaiah Koech Kiplagat was runner-up ahead of Cyrus Ruto, who beat the Olympic bronze medalist Thomas Longosiwa. Kenya's world record holder and Olympic champion David Rudisha won his 800-meter heat in 1 minute and 43.4 seconds, his fastest time this year. Turning to football, Algeria hosts Libya as Djibouti engage Sudan in the Africa Under-17 Championship qualifiers today, Friday. Tomorrow, Saturday, Seychelles engage Tanzania, Botswana welcome Namibia as Morocco encounter Mauritius in other qualifiers for the tournament. Meanwhile, Kenya's women's football team, Harambee Starlets, host their Ugandan opposite numbers, Uganda Falcons, in a friendly match in Kisumu, Western Kenya, tomorrow, Saturday. The Kenyans are preparing for their maiden appearance in the Africa Women's Cup of Nations due in Cameroon in November this year. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Eteguini, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, Jackson, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark, and have a good day. And that's it for this Friday, July 1st edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again Monday for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporter Peter Clotty, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington saying, have a nice day, Africa.
Next on Let's Talk. Jeans are a very popular part of our casual dressing around the world. Do you have a pair or more? Join host Sande Shomari and his guests discussing jeans. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.